I'm Aaron Weintraub, and this is Inside Kurdistan. So this is the final interview of my so-called fixer series, where I've been gathering some of the fixers I've come across through work outside of this podcast or through just socializing and networking here. And this episode is with someone who I'm very proud to call a friend and colleague now, Stella Martani. Stella, like many of the fixers here, began with working in Mosul, which we talk about, but she has also learned to navigate how to develop non-conflict stories post-war, which is a thing I have discussed in the past with other journalists and fixers. But what I find makes Stella unique is that she has a very principled approach towards gathering the sources to tell a story properly and deeply. It may be because she has some background in humanitarian work not coming at reporting on a story just by immediately going straight to the field. Maybe because she's a woman and therefore is often able to access places and people that male journalists and fixers may not be able to get through to as easily, at least. And we discussed both of these points. But overall, I would say her ability to develop stories and figure out the angles and dynamics for how to report on a story is deeply connected to her personality, which is very warm and laid back, but at the same time, very incisive and observant. And I think that comes through in our conversation. So with that explanation out of the way, here's Stella. I'm getting this laugh perfectly recorded right now. We're recording and we're opening with your laugh.
For 20 minutes, and that's the podcast.
The great thing about this particular episode of the podcast is either going to be hilarious for people to listen to or the most infuriating thing ever, because we have the two most distinct voices of anyone on the Erbil journalism scene. The small island of broken toys that is the Erbil journalism scene.
So embarrassing.
Nah, it's fine.
Nah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's good. It's good times. Everyone's going to have a migraine by the end of this episode, but it's okay. Let them. I'm getting your laugh loud and clear. This is fantastic.
Well, if people don't know me from my weird voice, they will know me from my laugh. That's like my signature.
The signature Stella chuckle. Good morning, sweetheart.
Good morning, sweetheart. It's 6:30.
It is 3 minutes past 12 o'clock right
You're
now.
You're not recording this, right?
I am recording this. You see that red light right there?
It should be green when it's recording, right?
No, it's red. Stella.
Okay, this was all off record.
This is off the record?
Yeah.
It's been, 3 weeks since I tried to get you into the studio? 2 weeks.
I think a month.
You're way less charitable than... Yeah, it's been about a month. So I hate to do this because this, immediately just, pulls another fixer into, defining who you are in your career. But, you started at UKH, and you started by linking up with Sangha, correct? And the Mosul crowd, or no? So how did...
I started after I graduated from UKH. All the other graduates, a lot of them became fixers. They were calling us the University of Fixers for a while. I knew Ayad and Sangha back then. They were the closest ones to me. And I started working with NGOs, and part of my job was access coordination.
Access coordination where? In Mosul?
To the camps, nearly liberated areas. And then I went to Mosul with two of my colleagues.
Sangha's a few years older than you, but you graduated before him, right? Because he kept going to the war.
Sangha was skipping exams for fixing.
for the university.
He's going to be mad at me for saying
No, it's funny. I love it. That's such a Sangha thing. It's all right. He's doing okay.
Yeah, he started fixing 2 years before me. And he was a blessing to me when I started. I got a lot of guidance and advice from him. He was like a school for me. And he still is.
Yeah. So what was your first story or maybe not story, because you were working first with NGOs. So what was your first project that you were working on as a fixer?
Yeah, so I was working in a project as a project officer with NGOs, mm-hmm. and I was like getting access, but also monitoring emergency aid delivery to the displaced people from the war, the camps, and like I said, the newly liberated areas.
Right.
But yeah, that's when I first started working with journalists. The first time we went to east side of Mosul,
mm-hmm.
when the war was on the west, in the west side, and there were like a couple explosions and a lot of drone attacks on the east side, because that's when like ISIS was trying to distract the army and the forces by attacking the east side, which was already retaken from ISIS.
What year was this? 2017? 2016?
End of 2016.
End of 2016. All right. You originally were like doing an office job, correct?
Yeah.
That didn't last.
My very first job was finance and admin officer.
I cannot picture you as that.
That was not my DNA.
Yeah, so clearly.
I did a project because the project officers didn't want to go to the camps. They thought it was close to the front line, and the program manager made me do one of the monitoring for the distribution projects we had, and then she grabbed me into the country director's office, and she was like, I want her in program. And I was like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I can't, yeah. How long did the financial officer, we were financial officer, what is that even called?
I was finance admin assistant.
So finance admin assistant.
I spent my day like working on Excel sheets in the office for 8 hours.
You are good at Excel.
Yeah.
No, you always compile everything. Every time you have notes, you put it into an Excel.
Yeah, I use Excel.
You're more organized than most of the fixers I know. So maybe that, maybe it did come in use.
It was different, but it also, like, working with NGOs has helped me a lot in my fixer career. Like, I was working in program, I was working with sensitive cases, providing, I was supervising projects for providing emergency aid and psychosocial first aid.
Mm-hmm.
To women and children who came out of war. So we were working like in Gayala, and because I got trained on like how to be trauma sensitive, conflict sensitive, culturally appropriate, when I'm doing interviews, when I'm talking to the survivors of war and conflict. So that's helped me a lot in the way I managed to do my journalistic interviews and the way I dealt with these people.
Could you give me some tips or some like insight onto like what kind of trauma appropriate or culturally appropriate like tactics that you use in an interview in a sensitive situation?
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be good for people to hear.
Yeah, I think you should always take time to like introduce yourself properly. Give time to these people to feel comfortable with you. You know, some journalists didn't know that back then, and they were like jumping into the interview and into the topics and asking very sensitive questions. So through the translation, I had to rephrase the questions and like take it slower.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was telling them actually to take it slow. So that's one thing, and you feel it in the people's face when they're getting uncomfortable, so you have to be, like, patient with them, give them the time to feel comfortable. Don't ask these questions that are making them feel uncomfortable or, like, bringing back the trauma.
And I think, like, something that people who might not be in this region might not realize, but, like, the importance of, like, sitting down, having a tea, making small talk about, like, the weather or whatever for, like, sometimes up to, like, an hour, 2 hours before you even get into anything. And even in, like, in conflict situations, obviously everything's intense, everything, and it's breaking news a lot of the time, so you have to move quickly. So I'm curious about how you balance that intensity. How are you able to shift from one mode to the other? Because that's important in order to get, like, the proper interview, the proper quotes, the proper perspective from people.
Exactly. Well, people were, like, I can say everyone we interviewed in the beginning during the conflict, everyone was traumatized in a way or another. So most of them wouldn't even like to talk, or they were not talkative at all. So for like a lot of times when we wanted to break ice with them and get into the conversation, we needed to have the social worker or the psychologist that was working with them there in order for them to trust us and feel comfortable talking to us. But I felt like for the woman, it was easier for me to communicate with them because they just felt safer around me.
Right.
And yeah, it was...
Well, I think you know my follow-up question is going to be, but it sounds... What's it like being a fixer and a woman?
Come on.
No, I know. But it is important. It's an important thing to discuss. I hate it when those kinds of questions are. They're so condescending. But it is important because, all of the fixers here are men. And especially for really sensitive things, trauma-sensitive things, men are often not well-equipped or necessarily, like, the most comfortable people to talk to in general. When it comes to trying to get someone to open up, feel comfortable and things like that. So I'm curious how you've been able to use that to your advantage and how also how it might sometimes detract from your ability to get other stories.
Yeah. Well, I've never actually felt a difference being a woman. Like no major differences. It has its downsides and its positive sides as well. I feel like I could manage to get access to places that maybe men are not allowed to get into, but I was also getting access to the places that where only men are allowed and women are not allowed to go in. So that was a good side. And also, like, I feel like as a woman, a lot of times I'm trusted more than men by the security forces and also by the people we are interviewing. And I'm saying that because when I work with female journalists, access is much easier than when I work with male journalists.
Like, why do you think that is?
They interrogate us more. They always feel like the man could be a spy or like a researcher. And it takes a bit longer to build the trust. But when I'm working with female journalists, everything is much smoother. With a lot of male journalists too, but I haven't encountered a very bad experience getting access with female journalists. I don't know. I think it's the culture or the country. They kind of marginalize or underestimate women. That's also part of it, probably, because they like, oh, she's a woman.
What could she possibly be doing?
Yeah.
Interesting. You mentioned some of the spaces that you were able to get into that women usually aren't allowed to. What are some of those spaces?
Like only men bars.
Ah.
Bingo bars in Mosul, male prisons. ISIS spaces in the camps where they have the ISIS juveniles. Normally women cannot go there, but we were going as journalists and they allowed us. But for example, they wouldn't let a man go into a maternity room in a hospital or a woman's shelter or a woman prison.
Do you think these like male only spaces were truly considered as like male only spaces, or do you think it was just kind of always assumed that a woman wouldn't be able to access that area? And so when you came along, they were just kind of like, well, yeah, sure, I get, like, yeah, why not? Or was it, did you have to build up that trust with the right authorities first?
No, I had to build that trust because they normally don't let women in there. Like, we were journalists, so we could do it. But, like, civilian women or, like, other women wouldn't be allowed in these spaces.
Something we've talked about just on the side is how conflict reporting can be sometimes a little rushed and then sometimes a little repetitive of news organizations are usually looking for the same kind of story, the same kind of footage and things like that. I'm curious from your perspective, as someone who comes with a more holistic background with NGO work, with psychosocial support, with sort of things that generally are used for more in-depth kind of reporting that take sort of longer and are more sensitive. If you could give me some of the more rewarding examples of stories that you were able to work on, that you were able to focus on as a fixer in Mosul.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that sometimes all the media attention is on the same topic. You could write a book about everyone that survived that conflict, literally. But it's just unfortunate that journalists sometimes tend to focus on the same thing, like I said, every day, telling the same story from the same location. After the war, we were able to focus on a lot broader stuff. And because I started fixing with war journalists, I didn't even know, like, there was other types of journalism that existed until after the conflict. And because we just saw everyone going to the front line and just focusing on the front line.
Is it more easy to do reporting on the front line? Or is now the more difficult period of time after the conflict, after the sort of outright war?
That's a good question, because during the war, like going to the front line, access was very easy. Everybody wanted to be covered, like the army, the Peshmerga, the Golden Division, the Federal Police. Everybody wanted journalists to join them and go to the front line and show what heroes they are. So access was really, really easy. Not that the risk was not very high. There was much higher risk and threat on our lives back then. But since the conflict ended, access has become much more difficult. But also for us, like working on different stories every time, I have to establish new contacts. I have to look for a unique thing. Sometimes I spend months looking for characters for a certain documentary or story that we are working on. So access-wise and connections-wise, it's much harder now than it was during the conflict.
And this is, okay, so something that we discussed a little bit before is dealing with people who have gone through a lot of trauma, have seen a lot of things, and dealing with them sensitively. I'm curious about your own mental state after covering a conflict like that. Have you been able to, because I meet some of the people, especially some of the older journalists who aren't necessarily always here, but they come back for a little bit, and you can tell they're fundamentally different people. I'm of a younger crowd, sort of the new generation that came in after Mosul, and I can tell the difference between my crowd, my generation, and these people. And the fixers are the ones that you can really see it with the most, because they still carry it with them and they're still here. How have you been able to deal with that trauma that you've had to witness and things like that, and continue your work?
Yeah. Usually when you ask any Iraqi this question, they're going to be like, nah, we're Iraqis. We don't get traumatized. Like, we grew up under the gunfire. We grew up in the wars. We don't care. That's not true, because secondary trauma is big. And witnessing these people suffer on a daily basis, it was really painful. Like, every day in 2017, going to Mosul and coming back to Erbil, at night, for me, like just seeing the city lights from a distance here, it felt like traveling between two very different worlds every single day, from like a completely destroyed area into like a place where people are partying and drinking and having fun, like the same day within the same 24 hours. We got a lot of secondary trauma, but maybe we didn't use the healthiest coping mechanisms back then, because that's not what most of the war journalists do.
Right.
What really helped me get through the trauma and the secondary trauma and the stress was going back to these places constantly, seeing people heal, watching them smile again, seeing them change, even their looks, their faces, the way they dressed. Seeing them rebuild their houses, like I watched all that. I watched them heal. I watched them rebuild. I watched them change the colors they were wearing. And that was a big part for my healing as well.
This is actually something I've not talked about on this podcast that I've actually been wanting to talk about let's talk about the culture of drinking and alcoholism in the journalism community and the fixing community as a coping mechanism, A, for conflict reporters, but B, also for people who have to deal with an enormous amount of stress in an industry that isn't always stable. That's a big thing that I think you've had to learn in the past year as someone who's had to sort of jump off the cliff of having a stable income and really get into this world. And a lot of the times we all end up at the same bar. we all end up meeting people through those connections at those bars and things like that, and establishing sort of stories and connections through that. But it's all based around drinking. And that's a long time. That's not a secret in journalism. That's a very open thing. So I'm curious about your own insights on how you've been able to deal with that and deal with that with other journalists.
Yeah, there was one thing that maybe all conflict journalists might agree with me on, which is they use unhealthy coping mechanisms, like going to the front line in 2017. Every day was like, we go there, it takes us forever to travel to Mosul when all the bridges were bombed, and it was a long road, and they were checking, the checkpoints were taking forever with a lot of aid from NGOs being delivered, too many trucks. So it was like we were coming back to Erbil around 10 or 11 p.m. sometimes. And after seeing and witnessing all this and hearing all the stories, seeing people bleed and die in front of you, it wasn't easy to just like be like, okay, I will go for a run and I will clear my mind. Like, where we ended up was Teachers Club.
I wasn't going to name them, but okay. Yeah.
Like, long table with journalists, fixers, and also some NGO people who were working near the front line. And everyone was talking about what they found, what they witnessed, what to do next, establishing new connections, meeting new people, drinking. And then at 4 in the morning, we were going back to the front line again and then coming back and doing the same thing. It has become like a routine, and that's what all the conflict journalists were doing. Actually, by matter of fact, there's a city, the Qalaqosh town. It was like completely burned by ISIS. It's turned into ashes. It was a ghost city. And we traveled through there to get to the west side of Mosul. And there was not even a single person living there or back, or not a single shop open. The first shop that opened on the road, it was a liquor store. And all the journalists, all the NGOs, everyone stopped there on the way back from the front lines. So before we even reached Erbil, we were drinking.
Supporting the local economy.
Yeah, and I noticed the more and more I worked with journalists after conflict, I noticed only war journalists do that.
Really? Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I mean, my crowd's not as much, like, we're a little softer. But we're also, I've noticed we're a little softer, the younger crowd. But I think we're less problematic as well. And I think we're healthier. But I do think that... I think we can all agree that drinking at the end of a long day on the road is fine if that's not like a routine. But if it becomes a routine, then that can really affect the reporting of an area. I mean, it can genuinely affect how the world perceives a conflict if all the journalists are going to this, you know, same parties, same bars every single night.
I know. Well, I'm telling you, we had few hours back in Erbil, and then we had to travel back. Nobody had the time to think about healthy coping mechanisms. But after the war, I witnessed a lot of journalists and fixers actually become healthier, like looking after themselves, drinking less, exercising. Some of them went into therapy. And
how about you?
We tried to do it shortly. It was an initiative by Pete Reed, who was killed in Ukraine in February. We used to go to his house, and it was his initiative. He was like gathering a number of fixers and journalists, and I remember Halan was also there. We did it for a little while, and we were all talking about all the unhealthy coping mechanisms we were using and how we should be different, and that was helpful. I didn't continue because I always drop off my therapy. I always stop with it, unfortunately. But yeah, I told you, just going back to these places helped with healing and healthier coping mechanisms. Also, like, you were talking about the difference between conflict journalists and the others. Like, it's much nicer, like, for your mental health. It's much easier on you when you're working on other stories, like the conflict ended and we started working about stories about art and culture, sports, football, gyms, people, like things that people couldn't do during ISIS occupation, using your phone again, knowing the world's news. Nobody knew that Trump was a president, because they didn't have much access to media.
Really? You just, like, found that out one day? Have there been any time since the conflict that you felt any, like, genuine, unique risk or, like, threat towards, like, the work that you're doing, either in Mosul or here or anywhere?
Yeah. That was a big, that was a bit tricky, because working at the front line, there was risk of, like, snipers, shooting, explosions, drone attacks, but we were always going to the front line with Humvees, with a lot of security forces around us. It was a bit trickier after the war, because to establish trust with these people, it was a bit hard, because after the war, I was like stopping at the red light and I was like, is this car next to me going to explode? Like, that's when I felt more fear than when I was at the front line, because I knew I was protected more at the front line. But other than that, like, I didn't have protection. I, like, we don't know at what time there will be a drone attack or an explosion, or what would the sleeper cells do, or seeing a woman working with journalists. Like, it was a bit tricky. But yeah, after that, when everything was peaceful in end of 2021, I was working with a journalist who lost her phone. She actually dropped her phone, and she didn't feel it. So she came back panicking.
Wait, where were you for this?
I was in the east side of Mosul.
Okay. All right.
In Hay El Ba'th.
Okay.
And we were photographing an amusement park. So that took 30 minutes, and then she realized that she dropped her phone when she was leaving the car. And I was like, open your computer and find your iPhone on it. So she did that, and we found the phone. It was like already 15, 20 minutes away.
Oh, no.
They were moving on the... They were crossing the fifth bridge into the west side of the city, and I started chasing that. But at the same time, I called one of my contacts, who was the head of local police in the west side of Mosul, and he said that his job's moved to Sinjar. He said, you can get support if you call any local police guys from the street to back you up. Then I called Sangar. I sent him my live location, because he was also in Sinjar that day.
Okay.
I shared my live location, and I was like, I'm chasing this location. I don't know if they are ISIS, if they have guns, or if it's just a family. I don't know who they are, but I'm chasing them, and I hope to find them. And he was like, okay, I will keep tracking you down. Yeah, we ended up on the... near the old bridge. There's like a corniche where all the men hang out at night. And it was already like, it was 9 o'clock when she lost the phone. And we ended up there. The location was there, but there were like 200, 300 boys and men around us. And we didn't know who had the phone. So before that, I asked police guys to support us. So there were two men from the local police, and they were asking everybody to show their phone, because they didn't have a permit to check anyone. So they asked one by one, show me your phone, show me what type of phone you have. Is this the one? No, it's not the one. Like, and then they asked for backup. So there were like two technical cars with like five men on like in the back of the pickup truck.
Oh my God.
And like they came to for backup, and they were also like, no, we don't have a permit to check anyone. So they started asking the guys, can you walk to that point and come back so we see if the location moves with you or not? And we were like the only two women there. Everybody was looking at us in a weird way because she had a computer in her hand,
right.
And like they don't know what we were doing.
This sounds like such a nightmare situation.
Yeah, so we passed more than 2 hours like that. It was past 11.
Okay.
And she made the phone beep. And as soon as she
only figured out that she can make the phone ring.
Yeah.
After 2 hours?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
She was very nervous. And So she, soon as she did that, the phone started moving on the map very fast. We knew that it was in a car or like...
motorcycle or something
like that. Yeah. Or something, because it started moving very fast. And we jumped into the car. The police guys were like, what do we do now? I was like, follow me. So they started following me with their lights and sirens. And
oh,
like,
my God.
I was driving through the old city when they, like, on one-way street, just the wrong side. And we stopped at the green light. We drove through the red light because I was driving according to where the location of the phone was. And then we crossed the Hulia Bridge. Mm-hmm. Then there was a roundabout and the street becomes tight. And that's when, like, she refreshed and the location of the phone was behind us. So I pulled over and I locked the street. Within 2 seconds, the guys behind me, they started the checkpoint and they started checking all the cars one by one. Then a little boy, like, he was younger than 18, he walks towards me with a phone in his hand with a broken screen. He was like, is that yours?
Oh, no.
And I started yelling at him because I told him, I called you 200 times. Why don't you pick up? I sent you messages. I told you stop and we will reward you. Otherwise, we will bring the police to chase you. I never imagined that we would find that phone. I had to take her to the airport at 5 in the morning. And it was already like 11:30 or something. They forced us to go to the police station. And it turns out they were 3 guys, all of them under 18. And they were all on one motorbike.
They were all stacked up on the same, oh, my yeah. God, with her phone?
These were the guys who took the phone, yeah. So they took us to the police station, and the police was insisting that we have to raise a lawsuit, but we didn't do it because she was leaving, and I had to deal with a lot of long court process. We told them, just call their parents, like, which doesn't exist in Iraq.
Yeah.
So I was like, no, I don't want to complain. Just let us go. We need to make it to the airport. But yeah, that night when I started chasing the phone, I never ever imagined that I will find it. I was like, I have to give it a try. I cannot just go back to Erbil and leave it like that, because she had all her expenses, all her invoices on that phone, and it was a brand new phone that she bought.
Oh my God. It's like a very low stakes Bourne movie. Well, I'm glad. Thank you for sharing that lovely fixer anecdote with us. I think it's a good way to round this out, I feel like. All right. Are you hot?
Very.
I'm hot very, too. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Arcade later.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Stella likes to go to the arcade to relieve stress.
Yeah, I love arcade games. I'm very good at it, by the way.
Yeah, I know. She won 500 tickets last time. It was a big deal. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, Stella, thanks so much for coming by. Finally, good to get you into the studio.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, I'm glad we made it work finally.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks so much to Stella for finally coming to the office and giving me some time to chat in the studio. Inside Kurdistan is brought to you by the Kurdistan Information Network, and you can check out our website at kurdistanin.net. If you have any questions or comments, be sure to send us an email at info@kurdistanin.net. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Aaron Weintraub, and this has been Inside Kurdistan.